Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hi, folks. My wonderful, wonderful audience. Many of you with me for years and years now. Always a pleasure, always an honor to talk with all of you. Once a week, I get to invite any person I want to come on my show and to talk with them and to talk with you. And it's a very special part of my week and my life. And I thank you, and I thank PRN, and I thank my engineer, and I think he's running the show now, Jesse, for the tremendous opportunity. Before I tell you about my most interesting guest today, he's not just interesting as a person. He's not just interesting for what he's doing. He's interesting because he's in Japan, and we have a heck of a time hooking up. So I'm hoping he's there. I'm not even going to ask him. I'm just going to hope he's there and tell you briefly that my latest frequent alert on Breggin.com is really, really interesting. I'll give you just the headline. 3/4 of American medical students and residents in training on psychiatric drugs, mostly stimulants and antidepressants. Find out the source of that data and find out some of the implications of it and see some other folks' opinions about it as well as mine on my frequent alerts. Now, my guest today from Japan is Wayne Douglas. Wayne, are you there? I got my fingers crossed. Wayne? No, I don't have Wayne online.
Hello?
Hello, Wayne?
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Hi, good to hear you.
Where'd you go? I thought, oh my God, I built up to this and then you weren't there, but you're there now.
I'm sorry, I was having a few technical difficulties. It's a bit early in the morning here. Sorry about that.
Yes, it's 5 a.m., folks, in Japan. It took us a while to figure that one out. And, you know, I think we actually missed our last show. We weren't able to carry it off live.
That's right. Yeah, sorry about that.
Well, no, listen. I'm just glad to have you on. Now, Wayne Douglas is a very interesting man. Actually, I've never talked. I've had him on before, but I haven't talked about his background. And I'm sure he doesn't mind because I got it off his website. But Wayne was adopted out as a 6-month-old baby. He grew up in a lower middle class neighborhood in New Zealand, not in Japan. You can hear his accent already. And then his adoptive father left the home when he was 4 years old, leaving his mother to raise him and his brother while holding down a full-time job. And then he began attending boarding school when he was 9 years old. So you've got a guy coming from adversity, and he went out to work and was doing, sounds like labor, building industry. And at age 23, he returned to high school and entered an adult education program to study Japanese. I just think this is a good story to hear. In the following year, he moved to the city to go on with his studies, and they didn't come cheap at all. And he had a student loan, a bank loan. His mom was helping him, and he didn't want to let her down. And he actually completed and got a scholarship, rather, for outstanding students of the Japanese language before graduating in 95. And then he eventually went to Japan. He's been in Japan working in international relations, translator, English teacher, events organizer. He's been there for more than 15 years now. Now, along the way, and I'll let him tell you that story, to whatever depth he wants to go into. He has talked about it before on the radio show, but I think we should get into it some again. He became involved with benzos and got very roughly treated at the hands of the Japanese courts, and gradually began to realize that this was going on around the world, where the debilitating effects of dependency and withdrawal were just not recognized by the so-called authorities. And he's really taken this issue on now, and his organization is W-BAD, B-A-D. It holds every July 11th, it holds a worldwide conference on dependency and related issues, I think with emphasis on the benzodiazepines. He feels deeply indebted to the writings of Heather Ashton, who has done some of the best work in the field in this area. And he's got a website and a Facebook. Let me just now, presuming you're still there.
Yes, yes.
Hand the mic over to you. And Wayne, you can pick up. We haven't done a pre-interview, folks, for this one, due to all of those glitches. But I do know Wayne, and Wayne knows me. And let me hand the mic over to you. You might want to talk about your most recent annual conference and tell people about it, or wherever you want to begin.
Okay, then, Peter. Actually, last time I spoke about my background and what happened with the Japanese doctor and going through the Japanese courts. And then I made my Supreme Court appeal 2 weeks after the Fukushima, 2 weeks before the Fukushima disaster. And then I got caught up in the Fukushima disaster, and I was making my appeal whilst evacuating amidst rotational power blackouts and radiation fallout and aftershocks and everything else. And I eventually ended up in evacuee housing with the whole world having fallen down around me, and just lost everything, lost all the people I was working with, just had nothing, just lost my court case. The whole world had fallen down around my ears, and I was just alone and isolated. And so I'd like to pick up from there this time, and how that actually led to the establishment of World Benzodiazepine Awareness Day.
Yes, so, just before you go on to that, I want to say that it's quite a stunning story. Do you remember the date of your show that you talked about that? If not, I can find it. Actually, people can find it by just simply going to Bregan.com and look up the radio shows, and we have an alphabetized list of the shows by name, and this is Wayne Douglas, and it's quite an amazing story that he tells about Fukushima and those experiences. Made it extremely real to me. So I just wanted to add that, but pick up then on the story.
Yeah, so basically from there, I just felt there was absolutely no justice, and I just thought it was so wrong. And then that's when I started looking around on Facebook and everything else to see what else was going on, because I'd been so consumed by my own court case, I hadn't had an opportunity to look around and see what else is happening around the world. And when I went into Facebook, I was absolutely shocked to see thousands and thousands of desperate people having similar experiences to what I was having. And it was I almost felt like I'd been at war for so many years, and then you walk into a burnt out village and it's just desolate. You see all these people chained and suffering and voices crying out in the dark. And I thought, oh my God, this is just terrible. And so many people worse off than me. And I think the key point is that these people were just ordinary, everyday people. They were not criminals. They were just regular, everyday citizens, and they were taking these drugs as prescribed, and yet it was just destroying them. And I understand that these drugs affect different people differently, but certainly there's a great number of people out there who are just being absolutely destroyed by these drugs. And when I say destroyed, I mean unless you actually experience it, it's very difficult to imagine just how tormenting it can be. And I mean, it's just destroying people's families. They're losing their husbands, they're losing their children's wives, they're losing their friends, their jobs. They're just suffering mentally and physically 24/7 for years after years. And sometimes for some people, the withdrawal is just going on for many, many years. We're not talking days, we're not talking weeks or even months, we're talking years. And I just thought, well, that's just so wrong. So slowly but surely, I started becoming more active in trying to raise awareness about the problem. And I had the opportunity to help out with the translation of the Ashton Manual. Well, actually, first I set up my website called Benzo Case Japan. And on my website, I tried to avail some information about my court case and what I'd been through, just sharing my story and some information. It's very basic in nature. But later, I had the opportunity to help out with the translation of the Ashton Manual in Japanese. I first got to know Professor Ashton during my court case, and she kindly gave me some guidance, and she provided some key information about the fact that people are able to experience a withdrawal reaction even though they continue to take the drug as prescribed because of tolerance and lost drug effect. And that's exactly what happened to me. So I was experiencing withdrawal even though I was still taking the drug. And quite often people will go to their doctor and complain of symptoms. I'm not getting any better, I'm getting worse. And quite often this withdrawal reaction is overlooked, and the doctors will often say, well, your original condition is getting worse, so let me prescribe some more. And of course that will work for a little while until the drug wears off again and it just gradually escalates. Or the doctor might misdiagnose them with something else, or they might prescribe multiple drugs. And then, of course, you have all kinds of problems. And I've just heard the most horrible stories of people who are just bedridden and suffering immensely. Dystonia and just all manner of symptoms, physical and mental. And they're just bedridden and they're just cast aside by society. They're just suffering in the dark. And even just 1 minute of this is intolerable, but these people are doing it not every minute, not every hour, not every day, but day after day, week after week, month after month, and they got no help because the doctors just don't listen to them. And quite often the doctors are persecuting and blaming the patient. It's all the patient's fault, so it's just adding more insult to injury, and they become more isolated and hopeless. And that is why we see a lot of suicides among these people, because it's just intolerable. It's just that bad. So where's the help? So these people desperately need professional, when I say professional, I mean help from people that actually understand these drugs and understand what the people are going through, and help them to come off and hopefully return to society as a healthy individual. And at the very least, they deserve that. So anyway, I had the opportunity to translate the Ashton Manual into Japanese, and I worked on that with a well-known doctor in Tokyo, Dr. Beppu, and a professor from a university hospital in northern Japan, and a translator from Kobe. And I had the opportunity to help out with that, and Professor Ashton gave me permission to avail the Ashton Manual in Japanese and English on my Benzo Case Japan website. From there, I helped out with various other things. Sorry, it's a bit early in the morning now, trying to remember, but eventually, then I started writing my book, which I'm working on now. The book is called Under the Rising Sun, and it's based on my own story. And Professor Ashton read through every chapter for me and gave me feedback the whole way. And in her words, she said, I hope that it will be a bestseller. And certainly I'm writing with every intent to make it as successful as possible, to help raise awareness through the medium of, well, let's say entertainment, but yeah, so I hope to educate people through a novel. I've written it as a novel, so that's the intention there. Anyway, so partway through, I receive an email from Barry Haslam in the United Kingdom. He's a seasoned campaigner. He's been campaigning for over 30 years. He's been involved in all sorts of activism. I understand he was involved in one of England's largest class action cases against the government and various pharmaceutical companies. And
spell his last name, please, Wayne.
Yes, it's Haslam, Barry Haslam. He's a tireless campaigner. He's done more than I could ever think of off the top of my head. But he posts on our Facebook page every now and then, so I'm sure you can catch up with him through there. Anyway, he sent an email to me one day a couple of years ago, and he just said in passing, he said, maybe we should have a World Benzo Day to help raise awareness about this scandal, he called it, and quite rightly so. And then I looked at it and just played on my mind, and I always thought to myself, because this problem is always kept under the table, shall we say, out of public view, and I always thought, how can we get people to speak up? And it played on my mind for so long. And then when I saw this email of Barry's, I thought, that's it. And to be honest, at that point in time, I was still in evacuee housing. I only had another year to go on my free accommodation, and I was going to use that last year to finish writing my book, and then I was going to return to New Zealand. And so it was a huge decision for me, because I knew in taking on that responsibility of setting up World Benzo Day, World Benzo Diazepine Awareness Day, that it would take that 1 year that I had left, and it would mean that I wouldn't be able to finish writing my book, and it would cause various complications, which it has done, and I'm feeling the heat of that right now, very much so. But after giving it a lot of thought, I decided that it needed to be done, and so I just conveniently blocked out the implications on my own life and dedicated the following year to setting up World Benzodiazepine Awareness Day. So as you say, it's held on July 11th, and the reason why it's held on that day is because it's Professor Ashton's birthday, and it's to commemorate all the work that she has done over so many decades. Even on a government level, right down to helping individuals who are just crying out for help through emails. She gave and she gave and she gave. And I had the privilege of meeting her grandson here in Tokyo. He was living here for a while, and we spoke in a cafe one day, and he says, I think she's going to continue until she can't go anymore. And I says, I think you're right. And that's exactly what she's done. I know she's not well at the moment, but she's just given and given and given, and she will continue to do so until her last breath, I'm sure. God bless her. So anyway, I felt it was the right thing to do to have World Benzodiazepine Awareness Day on her birthday to commemorate all that she's done. And so it took quite a while to set it up. Then after making a couple of posts on Facebook, I got an email from some victims who were suffering themselves and said, would you like some help? And they offered their help with various initiatives, such as setting up a T-shirt campaign, setting up a WBAD store that we've set up, where people can buy WBAD paraphernalia to help spread the word. Can be something as simple as a T-shirt or a coffee cup. It just gets people talking about the issue, which is good. And then eventually we had the first one was held in on July 11 last year. And the response was great. We had families coming out in support, people wearing their WBAD shirts, taking photos, sending in their stories. Sharing them on our Facebook page, Twitter. We have multiple videos, testimonies on our WBAD YouTube library. And I've heard that the FDA and other medical journals have been accessing these individual testimonies as public record to actually get a grasp on how people are actually, how these drugs are actually affecting some people. So that's great. So it just goes to show that WBAD is not only serving to raise awareness, but it's also providing a public resource, a record to show how these drugs are affecting people. So that's great. We had the build up, we had various activities going on, and then it came down to the day. So on the day, people were handing out pamphlets, just talk to someone, just tell someone. So participation can be something as simple as just saying to someone, hey, did you know July 11 is World Benzo Day? It can be anything from as simple as that to sharing information on the internet, right through to maybe campaigning in the streets. But it's just so important that people unite and just do a little something, and it doesn't matter how small it is. But what's really important here is being active, doing something, because it's no longer enough to sit back in the dark and just tolerate this. People need to speak up, because there's so much damage done to the public, to society, and the costs to society are incredible, with unemployment, violent crime, domestic disharmony, you name it, across the board. And it's, you know, the taxpayer and everyone's paying the price, either directly or indirectly. And these people, you know, deserve more. They deserve the opportunity to access facilities to be able to get off these drugs and to be able to rebuild their lives. Sorry, I might be spreading myself a bit wide here. For myself personally, I was in Tokyo for the inaugural event, and we had the opportunity to hand out pamphlets at Shinjuku Station in Tokyo, where I believe the equivalent of New Zealand's population of 4 million people pass through there every day. So it was a good location. And we were joined by three politicians just before an election, actually. And they actually campaigned with us, so that was fantastic. So we had use of a microphone, and a couple of politicians, Ms. Reiko Ueda, to be exact, she campaigned with us, and we handed out thousands of pamphlets. And the volunteers did a marvelous job. They handed out pamphlets for weeks before the main WBAD event. And then on July 11, we went along to the Ministry of Health in Tokyo. And there, people from all over Japan turned up, right from Okinawa down in the south, right up to Tohoku in the north, from Kyoto, traditional parts of Japan, Hiroshima, from all over, they all came. For the inaugural day, we had 30 people to begin with. And we had talks with 8 ministry staff, and 5 people got to talk about their experiences. And we submitted a petition, which was based on a doctor's petition, which I had the opportunity to participate in and give evidence as a patient/victim. And that petition was lodged. And then we followed up with the WBAD talks. And I'm happy to say, actually, that as a result, in March this year, all 44 types of benzodiazepines prescribed in Japan had their package inserts amended in March this year. They used
wow.
to say, yeah, that, they, that, yeah.
That's a real win.
That is, and that came quite quickly. That came only 1 or 2 years after the doctor's petition, and only a short time after the inaugural WBAD. So, yeah, and the amendment was that it used to say that these drugs are dependence forming on large regular doses, but it's now been amended to say that they are dependence forming on as prescribed clinical or therapeutic doses, or even on minimal doses. So that was quite an achievement to get that.
Yes, congratulations. And
yeah, so So actually, I'm going to Tokyo again on Wednesday next week with the same medical watchdog. It's called MedWatcher Japan, and Dr. Beppu is the vice president. So I got an email from him the other day, and we're going up again on Wednesday to do more work on that and to try and see if we can make more progress about getting the package inserts amended. So yeah, anyway, going back to Japan last year, we had talks at the ministry. They lasted for an hour. It was really liberating for the victims to come out and speak up to the authorities, to the people who actually govern, you know, these drugs, and actually tell them what had happened to them. It actually had a therapeutic effect, and I think that's one of the benefits about taking part in WBAD, is actually doing something and actually empowers you. It has a therapeutic effect. It gives you a sense of being liberated or justification. I just from what I've heard and feedback I've had from other people, it really helps them to actually do something proactive. So they told their stories, and some of them very harrowing. And I had one lady come up from Okinawa, and when she saw me, she came running up crying. And I said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "I came here from Okinawa to thank you more." She said, "Because I used the Ashton manual in Japanese to come off these drugs." She said that she was bedridden for something like 4 years, and she said, "Thanks to the Ashton manual, she used that to get off." I'd like to point out that the manual is only a guide, by the way, and that some people might find the reduction protocols a little too quick for them, but the idea is to accommodate for all individual factors, which might mean a slower taper for some. So anyway, she managed to get off the drugs and slowly get her life back, and she eventually went back to work, and she somehow got up the courage to get onto an airplane, and something she couldn't imagine doing a couple of years before that. She came up to Tokyo, she came running out to me crying, and she just said, "Thank you, you gave my life back." And then I saw her again in July this year at the second WBAD, and she was a completely different person. She looked healthy. She looked sharp. She was a good weight, a good color, totally different. So it just goes to show that for these people who are struggling, and many struggle for many years, that there is hope. And so just hang in there and keep at it, and your time will come. I mean, it seems some people, when you're actually suffering, it seems like the goal line's, you can't see the goal line. It's just a long, dark tunnel. You can't see the light at the end, but just hang in there and hang in there, and it'll come. It's a difficult, long, hard road, and my heart goes out to you, but it'll come. So be strong. I'd like to point out that, so that was the first WBAD. The second WBAD was held again in July 11 this year, and this time I had some wonderful help from some sufferers, people who are still going through a debilitating withdrawal, very, very sick, going through an extremely debilitating, painful withdrawal, and yet these people just put their hearts and souls into it. They set up the w-bad.org web page. They've just done such an amazing job. I'd like to encourage people to go along and have a look through there. There's a lot of information in there. There's materials, handouts for, there's handouts.
Let me interrupt a minute, Wayne.
Yeah,
we're doing
yeah.
a great job at 5 a.m. in the morning in Japan, and we're talking with Wayne Douglas, who has been a key figure in really getting information out about the benzodiazepine plague around the world that we've been enduring now since at least the 1960s, and we've got the subject now to come back to of the very latest one of your worldwide. I want to say first of all that it's very touching to hear your discussion of honoring such a great psychiatrist. and dedicating the meetings every year to her. And I think that's just wonderful. And I had a couple of questions just to kind of shift away a little and then come back to talking about the days.
Sure.
One of the questions is, I noticed early on that you refer to the benzo withdrawal lasting years.
Yeah.
I think there's some question about whether to call this withdrawal or whether to call it permanent injury that the person may or may not recover from, or potentially permanent injury. So what is your feeling about the use of language withdrawal versus persisting disability?
Yes, it's a good point, Peter, and I think language is extremely important here, because it's important to differentiate between addiction or addicts and people who are dependent, or as you say, permanent injury. And so we actually have a page on the website titled Language, and I encourage people to have a look at that, because these people are just ordinary everyday people. They're not abusing drugs, they're not using them for recreational use, and they're taking them as prescribed. And as you say, sometimes it's not always just a case of withdrawal, but there are cases of permanent injury. So I think language is extremely important, and I believe there are people out there who have permanent injury for sure. I've heard many stories, and I guess I'm no expert by any means, and but I guess that the thing is to recover as best you can, and then just learn to live with what you have left and work around it. Like Barry, for example, he has various problems even now, decades after stopping the drugs, but he's learned to live a full life just by employing coping techniques and working around it, and he still enjoys going out fishing and various things like that. So I think the thing is just to recover the best you can, and then just try to accept what may be a permanent injury, may or may not be, and then just learn to live around that. I can't really give advice on that because I'm not really a professional, but that's sort of my own personal take on it anyway. For me personally, the it took many years to recover. That may have been prolonged by my court case. For me, it took about 10 years before I really felt myself again. I do have a few lingering complaints, which I'd probably put down to permanent injury. I'm not sure, but you just have to learn to live with it and just work around it. And yeah.
Let go of that word complaints. That's the psychiatrists who call people's distress complaints. I mean, these are genuine symptoms you're having. What symptoms do persist for you?
For me, and I'm not so sure if it can be directly related to the drugs or not, but for me, for example, getting my letters mixed up when I'm writing or typing, that's one thing. Actually, not a lot. I did make quite a recovery.
So that's very encouraging, folks, for those of you out there that 10 years later he's feeling continuing recovery, and apparently you feel pretty much as good or better than ever in a lot of ways.
Yes, apart from the destruction to my life, of course, because that's another story, isn't it? Recovering from the drugs, one thing, but then recovering from the damage to your life is another one. So I haven't achieved that one yet.
We'll talk about that for a few minutes, because I think that's very important for people to hear and to share with you that you recover. But then, you know, there may be 2 years, 5 years, 10 years that you barely can recover in your memory. So talk about that, some of what that's about.
Well, actually, as I say, so even after recovery, recovering from the damage to your life can be ongoing, and you may not fully recover from that, I believe, in some cases. I mean, everyone's obviously having different experiences in different situations, but the damage is far-reaching. For me, I've continued to campaign and write my book, so I've never really got the opportunity to get back on my feet again. As long as you're fighting, you're a soldier, so as long as you're fighting, you're always going to be receiving harm yourself, so the harm goes on. But anyway, we do our best.
Have you returned to earning a living? I can't remember, separately from all this amazing work you're doing.
Well, actually, I'm only working part-time, and the work has been sparse, and generally only get paid for the work I do. So I struggle just to keep the electricity on, to be honest, and I've fallen behind in the rent and various things. And it looks like I may be going back to New Zealand in December. And after 18 years in Japan, that's a huge move. And so there's a lot of unknowns there, and but I've just sort of landed in that position now. I haven't finished my book, which is a little bit disappointing, but then I have to accept that, hey, we've got World Benzo Day now, so hopefully that's
You've been doing a lot of good in the universe.
So hopefully that's going to benefit and contribute to raising awareness. If I may, I'd just like to touch on a few other things that my team actually sent me in a few notes that I might like to cover. I think I mentioned that all of the adverse events that people have sent in to WBAD have been accessed by the FDA and various medical journals as public records, so that's great. I mentioned that people continue to commit suicide because they can't tolerate the symptoms. So I'm just flicking through the list here, excuse me. But there was actually an international benzodiazepine symposium held on September 15 to 17 in Bend, Oregon. And apparently it was well attended and was a success for education and awareness. And apparently it was the first of its kind to be backed and hosted by a medical group, namely the St. Charles Healthcare System. And experts in psychology, psychiatry, all concurred that benzodiazepines are not effective in the long-term treatment of anxiety and insomnia. The as-prescribed documentary film, which I believe that you may have had some involvement in, Peter, as-prescribed?
I think so, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, okay.
There's so many of those.
Anyway, there's a documentary coming out. It's directed by Holly Hardman. She's been doing an amazing job traveling around the States, filming on location. People have been telling their stories. The word is that the film's been tracked by leading film festivals at the moment, so that's encouraging. They have a Kickstarter campaign about to get underway, so people are encouraged to get in and support that. We've had people like Angela in the States and Raphael who have been running marathons with their WBAD T-shirts on, trying to raise funds and awareness for the problem. There's been activism in Massachusetts with the WBAD U.S. representative, Geraldine Burns. She's been pushing the state house, the benzo bill through the state house, and they're waiting on a response now. Apparently that was held on September 12th, and they believe there's a decent chance that the bill will be passed, and they're trying to get the bill passed so that people will get informed consent, that when the doctors prescribe these drugs, they will inform the patient about the risks and benefits and fully inform them, so that the patients will then have the opportunity to decide for themselves whether taking this drug is the right thing for them. Everyone should have that right anyway, regardless, I believe. But anyway, they're pushing that bill through, so all the best to them, and let's hope that that happens. Another thing we've been doing at WBAD is we've been getting state recognition, and at present we have WBAD is recognized in the state of Maryland and in the state of Massachusetts. And we actually have a page for that on our website, and the letters are all there. So people just need to go and download the letter, change it a little bit so that it's tailored to them, and then send it in, and they can get WBAD recognized in their own state. And to have WBAD recognized in every state in the United States would be amazing. So I really would like to encourage people to go and log on to our website, w-bad.org, and access the state information. You should find it under the site map, and go for it. Let's get some state recognition. Let's get some awareness. So, and apparently new articles are popping up all the time from, let's say, ignorant psychiatrists. Apparently, there's been one by a Dr. Gregory Smith, Chief of Psychiatric Services at the Aiken Barnwell Mental Health Center in South Carolina, stating that benzos are not bad and can sometimes even be used long-term in some patients. Well, I guess it can be in some, but we have to understand that it affects different people in different ways, and some people take them short-term or intermittently. But what we're really concerned about is doctors prescribing them long-term to people, repetitive doses, telling them that it's going to be okay, when in fact they're at risk, and people end up suffering tremendously through lack of information and ignorance. So that's what
Let me address for a minute. Mm. We're talking folks with Wayne Douglas. I like to make sure you get that again and again. The scientific evidence is that a significant portion of people become addicted in short 6 to 8 week trials. And if you're using Xanax for panic disorder, which is was just a way of getting the cell higher doses of Xanax and having another diagnosis, which was invented by Upjohn to sell Xanax, literally panic disorder invented by Upjohn. In those studies, a third or more of patients couldn't get off the drug when the trial stopped at 6 weeks and 7 weeks. That's catastrophic numbers. So by long-term, when we say long-term is dangerous, that's more than just it's more than a few weeks is what is being talked about. And in the studies for Xanax, the patients were worse off at 8 weeks than they were at the beginning when they tried to get them off. So again, I mean, the things that my colleagues in psychiatry and medicine have to ignore. I actually wrote when this came out, and in these studies for Xanax for panic disorder, they came out, Wayne, in the Archives of General Psychiatry years ago. And the archive basically reported the 6 week study, but if you read the fine print, you could see at 8 weeks they were worse. So I wrote to the, at that point I was not a very well known person, and I wrote to the head of the journal, the editor in chief, Daniel X. Friedman, and I said, Dr. Friedman, I noticed that you published these studies, which are vastly misleading in terms of patients being much worse at 8 weeks than in the beginning. And you just cite a 6 weeks and not very accurately. And could that have anything to do that you're a paid consultant to the Upjohn company? And he actually answered me, which they wouldn't usually do. He wrote back, what are you, a communist? I'm not influenced by money. So the blindness of the profession around these issues can't be exaggerated. When another benzo, Halcyon, back in George W. Bush's tenure as president, he got sick on the way to Japan because he was given a supposedly safe small dose of the benzo Halcyon.
Is that what it was? I saw that on TV when I was here. I saw that.
That was Halcyon, it made him sick, and I think he actually vomited at a dinner in Japan.
Yes.
In your place, your hometown there.
Well, not quite my hometown, second hometown perhaps. Yes.
Well, the New York Times at that point wrote a letter saying, how come our president gets a drug like Halcyon when it's been banned in Great Britain?
Right.
And so I wrote the New York Times, and I sent him a photograph of the president of the American Psychiatric Association getting a donation of $1.5 million from the Upjohn company. And I said, this doesn't happen quite as blatantly in Great Britain. That's why they could outlaw something in Great Britain that we give to our president. Wow. And the head of not the elected head, the paid executive director head of the APA, at the time Mel Sabshin, wrote a letter in retort to me at the New York Times, and he said that Dr. Bregan doesn't understand we have, and I'm quoting, an ethical partnership with the drug companies. Ethical partnership. So the politics behind how you get toxic drugs, highly neurotoxic, addictive drugs, on the market and push them is quite extraordinary. And these drugs can make people paranoid, and they can make people psychotic at times, especially the short-acting Xanax and Halcyon, and give you memory problems. I mean, what a drug to give to the President of the United States when he's going into Japan to negotiate with the Premier.
I don't suppose Donald Trump's on any of these drugs. Let's hope not.
I think Donald Trump is too full of energy to be drugged with anything. these are bad drugs, folks, and the fact that we give them to human beings so freely is really, really bad news.
I was going to say it's just bad for society. I mean, even for people who aren't taking them, they're affected in one way or another. So it's just like you say, it's astounding. I can't believe that it's actually allowed to happen over so many decades. It's just the power of the drug company and the almighty dollar, I guess.
Well, it is the industry, the power of industry, and I tend to be somebody who would like to believe in the free market and capitalism is really doing a great deal for humanity. But on the other hand, there's just no question that once corporations get large, once governments get large, they oppress people and they lose track of serving people. Right. So you could be at the FDA, and what you're really thinking about is your job and how when you retire, you're going to be a double dipper and get money from Upjohn supporting them the way you did when you were working at the FDA. And you work for these big companies, and you're no longer in the ethics that are spreading worldwide. No longer do people think that they owe anything to humanity. They owe something to their job. I mean, and a lot of these people, it's just the making of the money. And and that really, I'll tell you a little anecdote, folks, that in the last few weeks I've had occasion to talk to two people who are, or have been insiders in the drug industry, and both of them told me that it's just accepted party talk within the pharmaceutical industry that you don't want even to invent a drug that cures a disease, because what makes money are the drugs you have to take for the rest of your life without getting better. Right. And one of the comparisons was insulin. Where you could cure most diabetes with diet, but how many pharmaceutical industries are announcing that in a big black banner on their websites, or maybe a pink or red or purple banner on their websites, saying, by the way, if you could just settle down and eat a reasonable diet, here's a few alternatives, you may not ever need to take these drugs again. And it's a terrible, terrible problem.
I would just like to point out, Peter, I see we've only got a few minutes to go. If I could just quickly zap through a couple more things.
Please.
I also see that the opioids are receiving a lot of attention in the U.S. right now. But I think, as the WBED team has pointed out, that it's also important not to overlook benzodiazepines, because they've been involved in 30% of opioid deaths. And of course, these drugs don't mix very well with their additive effects. And so I think there needs to be some focus on the benzodiazepines as well. And also there's the Benzodiazepine Information Coalition, BIC, B-I-C, collaboration with WBED, has been working to get benzodiazepine-injured people to report their injuries to the FDA in the U.S. and to other regulating bodies. In the UK, some activists over there, and I believe Barry Haslam as well, among others, is trying to get the BBC in the UK to do an update of the 2001 BBC documentary, The Tranquilizer Trap, because that problem has been going on over there for decades, and they feel that it's time for an updated documentary. Claire Hanley from BIC and other campaigners have uploaded their testimonies and sent to Panorama on their blogs to encourage the UK media to take an interest. Her blog can be found at Benzovictim101 on WordPress. There's signatures going on to on the change.org petition calling the UK Health Select Committee for an independent inquiry into benzodiazepines are still pouring in. The decision on whether an inquiry will be granted in the UK will be announced within a month. If they decline, the petition will stay open and they will continue lobbying. They're also campaigning for a helpline for people who are in need of help. Yes, and that's about that. And then just some of World Benzodiazepine Awareness Day's objectives. So basically they want to get our objectives are to get recognition for this medically induced suffering, to raise awareness, to establish a mandatory maximum prescribing period of no more than 4 weeks of regular use. So we don't aim to deny access to these drugs for people who feel they might benefit from them. We would just like to see some controls put into place so that people are spared this unnecessary suffering. We would like to see the establishment of specialized withdrawal facilities and 24-hour helplines to help out people, because there's no help for them currently. Going into regular detox facilities aren't suitable because they reduce people too quickly. I've heard of people who have been cold turkeyed in them. They just cold turkey them right off benzodiazepines. So they're just totally not suitable at all. I've heard some horror stories about them. To encourage the implementation of much needed fully funded research and training for doctors and medical staff, to provide victims with a sense of purpose and justification. Our slogan has changed through unity, so we encourage people to step out of the dark. Don't be afraid, you're not alone. We're all standing together. And any little thing you can do, it will help. It will give you a sense of justification. And as I said before, it has a therapeutic effect. So the next World Benzodiazepine Awareness Day, July 11th, 2018, please show your support. Please come out and do something. There's a list of information on the website about how you can get involved. It can be very easy. So even people who are going through withdrawal and are sick can participate in any small way. And we can do this together. Together we can make a difference. So I'd just like to say thank you to everyone who has helped out, for your support. Tremendous work. People have campaigned over decades. You're all champions. You know, people go to the Olympics and they applaud Olympians in the stadium. These people are Olympians. They've like won the equivalent of 7 gold medals in a row. To do their work, they're doing whilst going through the most debilitating withdrawal is an Olympian effort, I can tell you. They're amazing.
Well, I think that's great. Have you covered all of the things that you brought with you that you would like to go over?
I have, Peter. Thank you.
Okay. And now, your group doesn't take a position of we'd be better off without the benzos. The position you're taking is we have to limit their use and be more cautious and only use them short term?
Well, actually, we're trying to be diplomatic about that, because I understand that they're prescribed to different people for different reasons. And once again, I'm not a doctor. I don't have a medical background, but I understand that it does help some people in some ways. And we know that if someone has a traumatic experience, like they've lost a loved one, these drugs can be helpful in the short term. It can help get them through a patch. But the idea then is to make a transition into more practical coping options. And then there are people, they're also prescribed for things like epilepsy and things like that. And people that take them intermittently as required. If they don't take them repetitively, as I understand it, it can benefit some people. So we don't want to deny people who feel they are getting benefit from these drugs. So we're not setting out to do that. What we're setting out to do is for doctors to inform people of the risks before they prescribe them, and for the doctors themselves to understand the potential dangers about prescribing these drugs repetitively long-term. And that's a good point, long-term. What is long-term? Because that's one of the things we're going to talk about in Tokyo next week, to try and get another update on the package inserts. They said that these drugs can be dependence-forming when prescribed on small therapeutic doses long-term. But what quantifies long-term? So we want to get that clarified. And as I understand it, long-term is anything more than about 2 or 4 weeks, because that's when the drugs tend to lose their effect. And that's when tolerance sets in and the withdrawal reactions and other neurological harms tend to form. So we would like to have that clarified in the package inserts as well. So again, we're not trying to deny access to people who feel they might benefit from the drug, but rather to save people from unnecessary suffering stemming from medical ignorance.
I think I like your approach a lot. I think it's very reasonable and very rational. I think you're doing great work, and it's amazing how much influence you're having already. You know, the benzodiazepines, folks, they're sedatives. They basically reinforce a system in the brain called GABA. And gamma-aminobutyric acid, and it's a receptor that is throughout the brain, and in fact, it's one of the first receptors to be found not just on the bodies of the cells, but on their axons that reach out and connect to other cells. And this was a startling revelation. And when you pump them up, which is what the drugs do, you increase the sedative slowing down or suppressive effect of the system, which is a control system. And if you give enough of these drugs, you can put a person into sedation and anesthesia and do a general surgery on them. And in fact, they are used, short-acting forms are used to produce a general anesthesia. And the way they work is by taking the edge off frontal lobe function, they can give a person a feeling of being calmer. They can get you to sleep if you're having trouble sleeping. But they can even sometimes help with withdrawal from other drugs for a brief time, for a few doses. But as Wayne Douglas is so clearly describing, that enters you right away into the risk of your getting the idea of using them often. And once you start using them for a couple of weeks or more, you are going to be impaired. Well, you're going to be impaired with the first dose, because that's how it works. Like all the psychiatric drugs, they impair you, and you get something out of that impairment. That is, if you're taking it voluntarily, by reducing your acuity as a human being, or the acuteness of your feelings, and so on and so forth, by being somewhat subdued. But I don't even view them very much as treatments. I view them as what they are, and they're very similar to alcohol and their effects. Many people are, just filling in some of the background science, many people are cross-addicted between alcohol and the benzos. By themselves, they were thought not to be very lethal, but first of all, and most importantly, they're often used in combination of other drugs, and even a little alcohol just leaps their toxicity. So listen, we're getting to an end. Wayne Douglas, congratulations on your good work. He's in Japan, folks. Maybe he'll be coming back to New Zealand, which will be a gift to New Zealand. Wayne, thank you for being on my show on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Thank you, Peter. Pleasure speaking to you.
Wonderful to talk to you, Wayne. Bye-bye,
folks.
Thank
you, Peter.
Bye-bye.